Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, and welcome to My Time Capsule. I'm Mike Fenton-Stevens, and My Time Capsule is a podcast where people pick five things from any time in their life that they wish they had in a time capsule. They can pick four things that they really love or cherish, but they also pick one thing that they'd like to forget, something they want to bury in the ground and never think of again. My guest in this episode is the actress and author Carol Drinkwater. As an actress, Carol is probably best known for her award-winning portrayal of Helen Herriot in the television adaptation of the James Herriot books All Creatures Great and Small, which led to her receiving the Variety Club Television Personality of the Year award in 1985. Carol was a member of the National Theatre Company under the leadership of Laurence Olivier and acted in numerous television series and films, including the highly successful and rather raunchy Bouquet of Barbed Wire and Chocky. She won a Critics' Circle Best Screen Actress Award for her role in the feature film Father, playing opposite Max von Sydow. And amongst many other films and television series, including The Sweeney and The Lady Killers, Carol appeared in Stanley Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange and the film adaptation of Beryl Bainbridge's novel An Awfully Big Adventure, directed by Mike Newell. While working in Australia, Carol wrote her first successful children's book, The Haunted School, which was produced as a television miniseries and film, and won the Chicago International Film Festival Gold Award for Children's Films. It was through this that she met her husband, Michel Noll, and relocated to Provence. Here, she continued to write children's and adult fiction, such as her My Story series and numerous other best-selling novels, alongside her best-selling memoirs about her experiences on her olive farm. She created a series of five documentary films inspired by her two Mediterranean travel books, The Olive Root and The Olive Tree. Root, spelled R-O-U-T-E, of course. I spoke to Carol at her lovely home in Provence. Sadly, I was in my home in Tunbridge Wells and we spoke over Zoom, but what a lovely, fascinating person she is. So I hope you enjoy our time capsule conversation.
Hello, how lovely to meet you, Carol.
Lovely to meet you too.
How are you? Where are you, in fact?
I'm overlooking the Bay of Cannes. We're having the most beautiful spring here. So, you know, we got down here about a week because we have a place outside Paris as well. So we came down a week or so ago and I was saying, oh, you know, backwards and forwards, blah, blah. But we got here and it's just been so beautiful and we've been pottering in the garden and eating outside and... And we really are blessed.
Yes, you really have sorted yourself out, haven't you?
Well, I think there were two things, really. Soon after I was able, sort of making my own decisions in my 20s, I decided, because I grew up in England, I'm actually more Irish than English. And I thought then, I don't really want what's going on here. And I took an Irish passport. And when I look back and think, what a blessing that was, you know, because of all this Brexit business, if I'd been stuck with an English passport, it would have made my life much more complicated.
Yes, completely.
So, well, of course, I'm married over here and everything now, so that sort of changes. But I think that without even realizing it, some of those mad decisions that I made when I was younger have actually come good. You know, they've shown me that, in fact, I'm very blessed with some of the choices I made.
Yes.
I mean, the French will go up in arms about every damn thing, you know. Mm-hmm. I admire them for it. I really do, because then you can't call them complacent.
No.
Sometimes I think they just don't realise how good it is here. We have an excellent health service. Most of it is paid for. Very good education. Most of it is free. The, you know, the class system is much less pronounced. I mean, of course, there is a class system. There is everywhere. Mm. But it's much less pronounced than in Britain. And we have good wine. And, you know, I just think that the general attitude to life is much healthier and rounded over
yes.
here.
There are simple things that happen in France that I've always admired and thought were such a sign of an organised society, really. If you walk into a bar in France, you say good evening to everyone before you buy a drink.
Yes. Not just in a bar, you go into the dentist or, you know, a hospital. It's always bonjour, monsieur, madame. Mm-hmm. No, I absolutely agree with you. I love it over here.
Yes. Your husband's French, of course, isn't he? So, you know.
French-German, actually. He was born in Germany, but he's been in France since he was in his teenage years, so he's much more French than he ever was German.
Yes.
It's difficult as an actor. I mean, that's has been the big cost for me. You know, it's not that I said I won't act. It's just that when you're not around, you know, it's much, much harder. I mean, fortunately, I've been concentrating on writing. But even so, I was sorry to let that has so fallen by the wayside. And that, for me, has been the big cost of being over here, I think.
Yes, I think there are always sacrifices. You will lose things always when you change your life.
Yeah.
But what a life. What a life. Let's talk about things then. Let's talk about some things you want to put into a time capsule.
Okay.
And see where that leads us and what it reveals about what you cherish and what you don't.
Okay. I mean, I don't know whether or not I'm cheating on some of these because I've been quite broad so that, so that I can include more things, as it were.
Yes.
My first is, this is a cheat one, I suppose. I would like my deceased mother and Michelle to be can I do that? Have two people in one time capsule?
Okay.
I mean, my mum came to live with us before she died. In fact, she died in my arms, most unexpectedly. But one of the things I recall regularly is that when mummy was living with us, because we've always been great travellers, you know, Michelle and I. And so, of course, when mummy came to live with us, it meant that, you know, we were travelling mummy as well, which wasn't always quite so easy, especially when she got into her 90s. But and I always rushed on ahead and made sure that the luggage was picked up and all that kind of. And I have this very, very strong image of Michelle would always, if we were getting off a plane, he would offer his arm. And so I always have this picture of the two of them. He was exceedingly good with my mother. And so I have this idea that I would like in my time capsule that there's the three of us there and that we look after each other. Because to be honest, my childhood was difficult, to put it mildly, for various reasons. And I think now as an older woman, rather than as the child looking up to my mother, I see very clearly what she went through and a lot of what she suffered and so much of her disappointments and et cetera. And so I think that in those last years, even before she came to live with us, I used to spend a lot of time with her and I used to go traveling and I had a place in Ireland and you know, we used to go there and we had just the two of us. You see, sometimes Michelle would come, but the two of us would go to Ireland and we would have the most hysterical time, you know, because we'd go to where she was born and we'd go to where her parents were buried and we'd go to places where her brother was married. And
so she's the Irish connection then?
Mummy was completely Irish. My father had Irish grandparents.
Right.
So I'm sort of three quarters Irish. I said to Brendan Doherty that I was 5/8 Irish. So, yes. And because she and I were, everyone thought we were sisters. So she was very proud of she being the younger. So we used to have a really riotous time together. And then Michelle would come sometimes along. And
he brought a stability, I think, to the trio of us, which Mummy appreciated very much. Mummy always appreciated good-looking men. And she would often say to me, you know, there's a handsome chap. Especially before I was married, she'd say, go after that one, you know. I married late, so Mummy was always trying to encourage me to find somebody.
It's funny, isn't it, how they talk about the English gentleman as if we have a monopoly on it.
Yes.
It's absolutely not the case, is it? That actually part of society in Germany and in France is that extreme politeness that they have built into the system. So, yes, I can absolutely see Michel there proffering his arm.
Exactly. So, you know, that would be in my time capsule. Michel does the cooking. He loves to cook, and Mummy was a terrible cook. Even when I was a child, it was beans on toast and stuff like that. She was, or she'd be cooking the Brussels sprouts for Christmas for 4 days, you know.
So Michel is a very successful producer.
He was a producer, and now he runs documentary film festivals, which he seems to absolutely love. He's got about 6, I think, that he runs. They're very small, niche, boutique things, but he loves it. He seems to be very successful at it. And any documentary contacts I have, I kind of, you know, bring them in so that, you know, he can widen all of that. So, yes, no, he has very much his career. He's not the man who sits in the kitchen, but he does love cooking. He absolutely does love cooking. And my mother loved eating. The three of us together was a very, very good fit. I think in all the time that Mummy used to come to stay here and then live with us, I don't think we ever once had a row, the three of us.
Wow.
Which I think is quite unusual.
Yes. Yes, I think in a relationship, having that person outside can bring in a lot of conflict.
Bristle it, can't it? It really can. I don't think we laughed a lot, the three of us together, and that was great. So, you know, and I think that Michelle gave back to Mummy her kind of sexuality, her femininity, which is, you're talking about European men. That is something that I think that is very much in the education, that understanding of how to make a woman feel important. Michelle's very good at that.
And recognising the beauty and the sensuality in someone, even with age.
Absolutely, even with age, absolutely. And, of course, that gave back great dignity to Mummy. Very important. And so those are my reasons, really, to pick the two of them together in the one capsule.
Lovely. I'm very happy to put two together, and I don't care if we're cheating at all. I think it's a lovely idea. Did you meet Michel through work, or did you just happen to meet elsewhere?
No. I was filming a children's miniseries in Australia, a drama, before Michel just went into documentary, in Melbourne. And Michel was the French he was the executive producer and the French link to it. At the time, I was doing All Creatures, so, you know, that was huge in Australia, along with lots of other countries. So I had some photographs taken of me with no makeup on and my hair all scrunched back. And so it went to Michel in Paris, and he said, I've never heard of her. And Lewis said, oh, well, she's, you know, big in television, blah, 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 blah. So Michel said, okay, I'll fly into London and have lunch with her and all of that, just to see. And then he got off the plane in London, got a phone, and now I know, of course, this is quite typical in his life, got a phone call almost as soon as he landed to say he was needed in Paris. And he turned around and got the next plane back. So I didn't meet him. And I only met him after the filming in Australia.
Right.
I was actually thinking of staying in Australia. I loved it out there. And Michel happened to be staying at the same hotel as me in Sydney, which is not such a coincidence because it was called Siebel Townhouse. They called it the Hotel to the Stars, and all the pop stars used to stay there.
I know it well. I've stayed there myself, yes.
Oh, do you? Nice place.
Yeah, it was great.
It was really, they came to the stars, and it really was a kind of home, you know, and there was always Tina Turner was there. I used to pass all these people in the lobby, you know, and so we were both staying there, and he said, will you have dinner with me tomorrow? And we went out for that famous dinner, and he asked me to marry him before we'd even got our first course.
Wow.
It took me 4 years to say yes.
But he was fairly certain. Yes, my wife says that the first night that we went out, I said to her, when we get married. So I didn't even bother asking.
Was it for you, love at first sight?
Absolutely, yes.
No, for me, it wasn't. Not in the sense that I wasn't attracted to him. But first of all, I didn't want to get married. I really wasn't
you know, even I was 34, I think, when I met him. And I mean, it just was not on my dance card at that stage. Mm. But then he came to London and he said, OK, let's meet at the hotel where he was going to be staying. And his plane was delayed. So he was 3 hours late. And I waited. He waited. But he walked into the hotel. It must have been 10 o'clock by then at night. And he put his hand there and he said, he had one of those winged collars, put his hand there and he said, I've kept you waiting this long. Will you just excuse me while I change my shirt? And he batted those blue eyes and I just thought, I'll never resist this man. And that for me was the defining moment.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
Well, there we are. Then he and your mother both have to go into the time capsule as the first thing. That's gorgeous. So what's number two?
When I was growing up in England, we lived in Bromley in Kent.
Mm-hmm.
For many years, I was at an Irish convent there. It was from about the age of seven or something through to when I left home at 18 or whatever it was. As I said, it wasn't always a happy period, my childhood. And I was at this Irish convent, which also was not always that happy.
Mm.
So I took my escape, as it were, in two things, writing and my dream of going on the stage.
Mm.
And in Bromley, there was, and I think it's still there, I'm pretty sure it's still there, the Churchill Theatre.
There is, yes.
Probably played it. Have you, Mike?
I have, yes.
I'm talking about the one before.
Before, yes.
It was a much shabbier place back then. And it had its stage door on what was the main high street then.
Yes.
Which was a smaller, more kind of coaching road. And alongside it was the library. I used to go and stand at the stage door and creep inside because there wasn't a stage doorman. So I used to creep inside. It was kind of a long, narrow corridor. And I'd creep inside there thinking one day.
Huh.
And what I remember about it, both the sound and the smell. And the smell for me was lightener stage makeup.
Mm.
Does that mean anything
to you? Absolutely means everything to me.
Yeah.
You would cover yourself in it.
Imagine putting it on your face now.
No.
But back then, it was that kind of thing. And the makeup was much more pronounced then, than it was.
When I was a young man, when I first started, we would have been caked in stuff.
Yeah, absolutely caked being the word. Mm. And it had a very particular smell. So I don't even know how to describe it. So I would stand inside this long corridor, which would eventually go to the backstage magic of dressing rooms and, you know, queues and tabs and all. I wouldn't venture that far. I would have been nervous to do that. But there I was, this girl, rather traumatized, a little overweight. And I would stand there, leaning against the wall, breathing in the smell of this makeup and also listening. I could hear, because on Mondays, they used to share, on Sundays, Mondays, they used to change the set for that week's performance because it was probably weekly rep then. But anyway, I would be standing there listening to the backstage staff yelling. And for me, it was really the beginning of the consolidation of that dream, you know. I thought to myself, this is where I will be able to make my mark or express myself, find a family. All those kind of things were very much part of what that meant for me. I mean, I'd stand there for hours in my school uniform. No one ever said anything to me. I think they just, if anyone came along, they just walked past me, hello, and go on past me. No one said, what are you doing standing here?
I think to an extent they would have recognised it. Do you know, I think when people are in the theatre, they instantly recognise somebody who's in love with it.
You know, Mike, you're probably absolutely right. I hadn't thought about that. But I mean, because I suppose if you asked me what age I was when this was going on, I would say between 9 and 12. By the time I was 11, I was actually performing at the Bromley Little Theatre, which was an amateur or semi-amateur theatre. So I did some children's parts there. So that was my first real step into it, as it were. But so it would have been before I was 11, maybe 9 to 11, something like that. And then from there, I would go to the library. So that was my second haven, one might say, my kind of peace haven. The library, which of course was a tranquil place because it was set in a garden. And when I would go into the library, and that was right up until, you know, when I was doing my O levels and A levels, I'd go and sit in the library and for the research, of course, but mainly for the sense that I felt that idea of being surrounded by books, by words, by travel.
by escape, you know. It was all about adventure and escape. So that little pocket of Bromley there would be a time capsule for me.
Yes.
And I've since read at the library, read one of my, you know, done a book signing evening, reading from my one of my books there. So and I played the Churchill. So in a way, I could sort of say that those little dreams of Bromley have come true. You know?
Yes, absolutely.
So I put that in a time capsule because I suppose it's the time capsule of hope.
No, absolutely. I went to the old theatre before they built the new one, and I went to the first night of the Churchill Theatre to see Roy Castle in Mr. Polly. And also, when I was at school, I performed quite regularly at the Bromley Little Theatre.
No!
Yes.
That is extraordinary.
Yeah. So I know exactly what you're talking about. And for me, it's also very powerful memories. I have exactly that shared experience of standing backstage when I shouldn't really have been there and just thinking, you know, maybe. Almost as if somebody would say, oh, you could play this part. That sort of mad dreams that you have.
What did you do at the Little Theatre?
Oh, a number of things. Salad Days, Toad of Toad Hall, I think we did as a Christmas production, The Merry Wives of Windsor. And as we know, there are many great amateur actors who just never go on into becoming actors. So it was a great lesson.
It actually really was. I mean, now I look back having all the experiences I've had in my life, you know, it could have been awful, but actually as a little introduction to the real professional world of theatre, it was pretty damn good, I think.
One of the best performances I've ever seen or been on stage with was by an amateur actor at that theatre.
Really?
Yeah, a man called Bob Kirby, who played the lead in A Man for All Seasons, and he was just brilliant in it. I've acted with some great professional actors, but none of them have quite engaged me on stage the way that he did. Okay, well, let's put those wonderful memories of both sides of your life, the acting, and then also that early in life, that desire to write, to be a writer.
Oh, I was already writing then, you know. I had my first thing published when I was 10.
Wow.
A magazine called Girl Magazine that my parents used to buy me weekly, I suppose. And I wrote to them and sent them a little story, a silly story of losing my petticoat at a dance. I mean, a really silly, embarrassing thing. And they published it. They sent me a 5-shilling postal order, which
Marvellous.
Probably with inflation is more than I get paid for my writing.
Possibly.
I certainly didn't send it in with the intention of being paid for it. I just wanted to share. So yes, that was my first professional piece of writing, I suppose.
Fantastic. Okay, well, let's move on and find out what else you've got on your list of things you wanted a time capsule. Okay, apologies for this interruption, but this is the revenue-generating part of this podcast, the ads. Hopefully, we'll be back very soon.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome back to part two of My Time Capsule with the actor and author, Carol Drinkwater. Right, let's find out what else Carol would like to preserve in her time capsule.
My very first book that was published was called The Haunted School. It was a children's young people's story set in Australia, which I'd come up with the idea when I was filming over there. I'd read something about governesses in the 19th century being shipped out there because there was a lack of women out there. So they sent these poor English governesses out there. Mm. to work in households and hopefully marry and bring a bit of fertility to the to the new community, the colonies. So it's the moment, and it continues always, it doesn't lessen, of when your first book arrived, the first printed copy that you are sent. So you get to see the first copy. And that was first published in Australia, that book, because it was set in Australia and I sold it to Penguin Australia.
Mm.
So it came here to the bottom of our drive here, and I was coming up the drive and saw there was an envelope for me and tore it open as I came up the drive here. We're on a hillside. And I pulled it out, and there it was, The Haunted School. And I, the sensation of my first book being published was just overwhelming. I mean, Michel wasn't here, so I was on my own to relish this moment. I couldn't share it with him there and then. And there weren't mobile phones then, so I had to wait until I could talk to him. Mm-hmm. But it was that moment of holding it, clutching it in the drive, and realizing that I had actually written my first book. And I have to say that that sensation, and other writers I'm sure will tell you exactly the same, this is not unusual, that every single book, it doesn't lessen that moment, you know, that extraordinary sense of images in the head made real and turned into a, you know, someone actually said, I didn't know you knew that many words, Carol. But it is an incredibly special moment. And that in itself, that's a little capsule in itself, I suppose.
Yeah.
And our love of words. I mean, you can't be an actor and not love words and not begin to appreciate as you, when you work on good scripts, less good scripts, you do begin to understand the power of the word, the use of language, and the love of language, don't you? I mean, I don't suppose there's an actor out there that doesn't love words and language and what you can do with it and how right it is that the pen is mightier than the sword.
Mm.
I'm not saying that's true of my little book that I held there and then. But let me tell you, that little book still sells. And that was published, I think, in about 1986.
It's an extraordinary thing, isn't it, to think of people that you'll never know all around the world who at different times have read things that you've written.
It's
just this spreading of this thing around the world and all these people who are now connected with you because of that thing. I get that feeling somewhat with this, when, in fact, people get in touch with me and say, oh, I really enjoyed that episode, or I love listening to that person. And you think, they're from all over the world.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary that you and I having this conversation will eventually be heard by people in all sorts of places.
People, all kinds of places, yes. Mm. No, absolutely. And I mean, I get, for example, I've received letters from people who've said things like, because in one of the books, The Olive Season, I write about losing a child, a pregnancy, miscarrying, and not being able to, being told that I probably couldn't carry a child full term. So that was at the time, it was a pretty painful experience for me. I mean, now my life is so rich that I recognize I've been given lots of other gifts, you know, and I have wonderful stepchildren and we have grandchildren. So it's, you know, it's not a pain for me.
Mm.
But it did unlock for lots of people, men as well as women, an ability to talk about the grief of miscarriage, because miscarriage is not necessarily always given the same value as the loss of a fully born child.
No.
So lots of people, their grieving sort of goes unmarked.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't, this had nothing to, I just was writing about it because it came up in that particular episode of Our Life Here. And also then planting trees was my way of using my nurturing energy and also doing something that will be here for hundreds of years after us, you know.
Yes.
People who plant trees think of the future, you know, they plant for the future, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
So I had so many letters, and when I went out to promote the book, which was very difficult, reading extracts from it on stages or, you know, literary festivals and everything, the amount of people that then contacted me about their grief and the fact that they felt they couldn't that if they mentioned it to their family, the family would say, oh, but, you know, it wasn't a child fully born, or that they would in some way be dismissed. And many felt that they had to keep their grief under wraps.
Mm.
So that was a real gift to me, to discover that, in fact, something that I was writing about purely for myself in my own storytelling actually had unlocked a key for other people to express their own grief. And I also started getting some letters from where a psychoanalyst had recommended
to some of her patients to read my Oliphant books.
Wow.
Because she said to them that the outcome in the books was so uplifting that there was a kind of energy within them that might help people get through whatever it was. And I was astounded by that. I felt so humbled by that, you know.
What's lovely about it, I think, is that if somebody sets out to write something that is going to tell people that thing, it doesn't work. It works because it comes from you genuinely telling something that is just part of your life.
Touching something in the soul, you know.
Yes.
It's just, but, you know, sometimes you can speak to other people's souls, a part of other people that is not necessarily always open, you know. I mean, yes. We have it in the theatre. There are moments in the theatre, you know this very well, Mike, that something happens in a theatre and you hear the audience get it. Mm-hmm. You hear the audience being moved.
Yes, isn't it strange how communicative silence can be?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Mm.
And then there is a silent return as well, you know. The whole thing becomes a kind of a circular expression with nothing being said at all, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the most powerful moments in theatre, for me, have been those moments. Don't you agree?
Absolutely, yes. Yes, it's an extraordinary thing. I mean, it's almost inexplicable because you say, well, nothing happened. I stopped. They didn't do anything. And you know that they got it.
Yeah.
It is an extraordinary thing, isn't it?
I think one of the sadnesses for me about theatre, rather than film or writing books or music, which I don't write, I have no musical bones in me at all, is that it's gone. It's completely ephemeral. You come out of the theatre and you know, I mean, you know, there are those nights when you think, I don't know, it just didn't work in the same way. And then the next night you leave the theatre and you think, job done tonight. There really was something out there that was magic, you know, magic in the pure sense of the word. And the sadness of theatre, of course, is that it's completely gone. You can't hold on to it in any way at all. You can't repeat it. I mean, you can repeat it, but it's not that night. It will never be that night again.
Yes.
So the only thing to do with it would be to put it in a time capsule.
There you are. You see, that's how we preserve it. That's
the point.
We preserve it. Indeed. Yes. I mean, it's sort of the charm of it, the joy of it, the fact that it's so ephemeral. But also, it's the shame of it. You know, you sort of go, oh, what a shame that I can't ever see that again or watch it again. Or you just have to try to remember it.
Mm.
And you do. That's the thing, is it stays with you.
Well,
and I think that actually, if it's done properly, it stays with an audience as well.
Yes, I absolutely agree with you. I mean, don't we all know that there's been a particular night in the theatre when you've been in the audience and you've thought, I have just witnessed something very special, you know, in the old pagan sense of the word, you know, that we all touched the same note at the same time, you know.
Yes.
Extraordinary.
Whereas with the writing, of course, you do have that wonderful thing, the actual object. There it is. I mean, it's an amazing thing, isn't it, that of all the things that have been written, you've been the one to be chosen.
Yes, it is quite something. I mean, something, and I don't mean this to sound in any way egotistical, but the one thing that changed for me when I started writing rather than performing was I was God in my own universe. Sort of, it can rain if I say it can rain, or this person can die if I decide they die. So there is absolutely that. And it also brings along with it, I believe, a responsibility, an immense responsibility, because I think that once you know that what you have to say will be listened to, even on a very surface level, then I think one has to take care about what you have to say.
Mm.
I mean, I was reading something on Facebook this morning, a debate that was going on about Israel, Gaza, etc., where I've spent a lot of time, or a fair amount of time, writing, filming, witnessing, planting olive trees in the West Bank, you know, and somebody said something and I wrote a piece, which I wouldn't normally do, but I just thought sometimes, you know, you have to stand up and be witness to what you have experienced.
Mm.
And I think that sense of responsibility is very pronounced once you start writing. I think it becomes something. I don't want it to be on my high horse about it, but I think that's one of the transitions that happened for me when I started writing, is that I began... Slowly, I began to see that every time I had anything to say, I better be sure that I had some backup within myself
not what anybody else thought, but within myself, an honesty to myself and witness to myself of what it was I was writing down, because at some point it comes back at you.
Yeah, yeah, quite. Well, I mean, I also think that it just doesn't work when people don't do that. You can see it sometimes that people have tried to write something that you think, I don't believe that you believe this. I think you're writing it because you think we want to hear it.
Yeah.
And that's a mistake, I'm sure.
Yes, indeed a mistake. Yeah.
Yes. Well, all right, lovely. Well, I'm going to put that very first, The Haunted School.
The Haunted School, yeah.
The Haunted School.
I think I'm now writing my 25th book, I think it is.
Wow. That's amazing.
A lot of words.
Incredible.
A lot of words.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, lovely. We'll put that in. So we've only got two things left, Carol. We've got to put one in that you love and one that you want to put in there so you can forget it.
Well, the one that I want to bury, I don't know, is actually, it's Carol in my 20s. You know, I was so gauche and sometimes so ill-informed, you know, that I look back on my life and I feel that the 20s was the time when I really made a lot of mistakes. Mm-hmm. You know? I mean, some of them, like, for example, this is a very light one, but, you know, there was a chap who was dating me occasionally. He was trying to bed me and not my cup of tea at all. But anyway, he took me to the theatre to the first night of, I think it was Evita. And there was a party afterwards, a huge, huge, big party. Anyway, there was a group of people standing together with Hal Prince, production, a big, major Hal Prince. And there was a group of people all in a circle. And Hal Prince was one of them. And most of them were women and just Hal Prince. And this chap that I was with shoved me into the circle. He just very vulgarly shoved me into this. And I was so nervous. And these people all sort of looked and turned around. And Hal Prince kind of looked like this. And he said, hello. And like that. And someone said, this is Hal Prince. And I said, oh, hi. Did you see the show? Did you enjoy it? And he went, did I see the show? Honey, I directed it.
Oh.
I felt so humiliated. It was also this chap. I mean, he should not have pushed me into a group of people like that. But I remember going to meet Roman Polanski for a film, and it was in Park Lane, the big hotel, and this big suite that he was hiring while he was interviewing. And I came in to meet him, and he moved towards me. He was coming at me, as it were. I mean, I don't think in any sinister sense. He was just moving towards me. But my instinct was to move back, and I moved backwards and fell backwards over a coffee table, landed slap on the coffee table with my leg. And he kind of recoiled in horror. I got on my feet and leave. So I kind of have this sense of myself in my 20s where I just kept putting my feet in it and not being very, I don't know how I would change this. You know, I mean, I suppose it's part of the process of growing up, isn't it? And learning how to be at ease and graceful in company.
Mm.
But I suppose that is the part of me that, or the part of my life, that if I had to kind of shove it under the carpet, you know, I mean, that's just, there were lots of them, you know, I mean, finding myself in situations where I couldn't find way, I didn't know how to get myself out of situation that I'd got myself into foolishly and then would make mistakes getting myself out of the situation. So it's that sort of gauche period of, and having come from a background which was, as I say, difficult. This was my sort of learning period, you know. And I do look back on myself and think, oh, Carol, really? Anybody's still alive to remember that? Oh, my goodness. So, you know, that.
Yes. But I think we have to be slightly forgiving of our younger selves because, as you say, we knew nothing. We felt as if we ought to, but actually, to a large extent, we were completely innocent. I know I was.
I think the sadness is that I thought I knew so much, you know. Mm-hmm. There is truth, isn't there, in those who think they know nothing. Mm. I do think there's a lot of truth in that. And I suppose now I know so much less than I thought I knew then.
Mm.
That makes sense.
Yes, it does, yes. That actually, as time goes on, you realise more and more the things you don't know.
Absolutely. And how much there is out there, how many books there are to read, how much mm-hmm. music that you'll never hear, how many countries that you'll never visit, people you'll never meet.
Yes.
And I don't mean that in a negative or triste sense. I mean it in the sense that it is so overwhelming what's out there, and it is so abundant and generous, you know, what life has to offer. Mm. You know, one can't glut on all of it.
But, yes, well, I think that you also begin to realise that actually your ignorance is rather glorious. You can revel in your ignorance, as it were. You can enjoy the fact that there are so many things out there that you can learn, and it takes the pressure off you. When you're young, you feel you ought to know everything.
Well, you do actually think you do know, you know. I mean, I definitely was arrogant in the sense that I felt that, you know, I had a wonderful drama school training and they were very applauding of me. And so I think I thought that, you know, that it was going to be the God's gift of you know, God's gift to British theatre, dear God. You know. Oh, how embarrassing. So, you know that, yes, but I you're right. One has to have a kind of sense of humour and a kind of generosity towards one's younger self. Mm. But I think that taking the pressure off, I mean, I now say to myself, there are certain areas of life about which I will never know anything, which is a great sadness. I don't cut myself off from it, but no. I can't see how I will ever get round to it.
No, not enough hours in a day.
Exactly that. Yes.
Well, we will put your young self in there, but we will put the 20-year-old Carol in there.
Yeah.
But, you know, with kindness.
Okay, with kindness.
Also in a world where, in fact, she thinks she knows everything and everything's fine.
Oh, you're a very, very generous and benign host.
Good. Oh, lovely. So just one thing more to put in there, I'm afraid.
Well, the one thing I'm going to is the sound and the sense, the olfactory sense of this olive farm, which, alas, you can't see today. But we have a stunning view over the sea, stunning views from all over the place, over the sea, on the hillside over there, up in the pine forest there, and various platforms where we can have drinks in the evening and stuff like that. So the beauty, the absolute beauty of watching and being able to just breathe in the Mediterranean from here is one of the best gifts that's been given to me in my life, absolutely. And the scent of the, I mean, now particularly because it's spring here, it's full-blown spring and you go outside and everything's buzzing and pollinating and whacking about the land, doing whatever it is, nesting, whatever it is they're doing. There's all of that going on, and there's all the blossoms, which are just magnificent. We've got, at the moment, we've got the rosemary, we've got the lavender coming in, we've got the jasmine coming now, we've got the orange blossom just opening up, the cherries in full blossom, the olive will be next month. You know, so all of that, I put it in one package, which is kind of sight and smell, you know, of this funny little house, which is, it's still falling to pieces. It was falling to pieces when we bought it. We've invested too much money in it, and it's falling to pieces again because it all needs redoing, you know. But in spite of all that, it's the nature, the earth of the place. And the lavender, which is just breaking into flower now, has two very particular memories for me. The lavender, when I was a girl at home with my parents, for mummy's birthday and Christmas, I used to save, I think it was 5 shillings. I used to type my father's contracts for him to earn money so that I could buy my mother for 5 shillings or whatever it was, Yardley's lavender water. And there was a small size, and I used to try and get the size that was slightly bigger. She loved it, this lavender water. It was compared to the lavender that we get down here. I mean, it was not quite so potent in terms of its perfume, but it was lovely and she was very fond of it. So I used to work to save up to buy her the lavender water. So when I'm here on the land and I whiff the lavender, I just breathe it in. I remember that memory of how important it was for me to be able to achieve the moment when I could go into the shop and buy her present, which takes me on to another memory, slightly more painful memory. I was filming in Poland when my father had a stroke, and I'd written the scripts of a television series, and they were being tough with me about the scripts because they wanted to put in something that was nothing to do with the story, but in some way sold the idea of Poland to the rest of the world. And I was fighting this because I felt that it was inappropriate to the story. Anyway, so it meant that I was up all night, every night, rewriting scripts. And when I say all night, every night, I mean I was 4 days and 4 nights without any sleep. And then on the Friday evening, the producer said to me, come on, we're going out for some dinner. You need a break. And I was kind of bamboozled in the head. I had a glass of wine and that kind of knocked me for six. And I said, I'm going back to get some sleep. And it was Friday evening. And when I got back to the hotel, there was a call from my mother saying, there's nothing you can do. So don't try and come. Your father's had a stroke. And he was young. He was 70. Mm. And I sat up all night, even though I needed the sleep. And I heard my father say, Carol, darling, it's Daddy. And I knew I had to get out of Poland to see him. I knew this was him calling me. And getting out of Poland back then was no joke. It wasn't like flights now. It wasn't EasyJet in and out and all that kind of stuff. The country had only just opened up, literally just post-communist days. And I went down to breakfast and said to the receptionist, I need to get a flight to London and back for Sunday so that I'd be there for Monday filming. And I rang the producer's room and I said, listen, sorry to call you so early, but this has happened, blah, blah, blah. And I really want to go. It means something to me to go. Anyway, everybody moved heaven and earth to get me out there. I think I had to make three flights to get to England. I hired a car at the airport. I nearly killed half the world getting to the hospital, driving like a lunatic. And I got to the hospital and the nurse said to me, she said, I just told him you're here. And she said, his breathing has changed. He knows you're here. So I went to his bedside. My mother was there and my uncle was there. And my mother had in her hand one of her handkerchiefs. I've probably still got it. And she was dousing it with lavender water. And she was putting it on my father's face and head there like that. And I sat and watched her. And I could see she was fighting not to face what she knew was the reality. And so that smell of lavender water came back to me again there. And I sat all night, so it was my fifth or sixth night with no sleep. I sat up all night with my father, and I had to be on a plane the next day, and he died while I was on the flight. Mm. And I got the news when I arrived back in Warsaw. So the beauty of this place, the scenery, the vista, this amazing home, even though it's a falling apart home, that I've been given or life has lent me for a while. After I'd had a very difficult childhood, and this feels like the kind of, like the balm, you know, that somehow fate has given me charge of for a short while and shown me that there is immense happiness within a household. Again, it meant taking the whole thing back round to the beginning to have my mother live with us. And that lavender water and that comes from this sense of lavender and the smell that is wafts its way up the hillside as we sit in the evenings and have our glass of wine. So that's my last one.
It's beautiful. When you talk about being young and thinking you know everything and then getting older and realizing that there are many things you don't know, one of the things you do learn is that actually those awful, painful things that have happened to you in life make those moments of sitting with a glass of wine and the breeze blowing the lavender up the hill, that sort of moment becomes all the more precious.
There's a sort of miracle in this, you know. One of the little miracles that you can just walk past in the street or not, you know, not be aware of, but that become so precious. You know, the fact that life is constantly giving back. If you just allow yourself to look to see what's out there, that it's we went through a period when we split up, Michelle and I, and it was a very dark period for me. And Mummy said, come home. And I said, but this is home. And I stayed here and I watered the olive trees. And in the midsummer, when everything was totally barren here, it doesn't rain and desertification and all that looks like it's on its way in and the ground is just nothing, I started to see all these brilliantly coloured wildflowers just that survive in arid zones. Mm. And I realised then, and I wrote about this in one of my books, that even in the midst of the most drought-ridden circumstances, there is colour and there is life. Mm-hmm. We just have to pause and look for it, you know. We just have to take the time. And I think that's true also of this, you know, lavender was my bond with my mother when things were so tough when I was a child. And there it was, you know, has come back round again in my life. When I can look back over my life and actually say to myself, well, you know, I don't have children, okay, but I do have my books, which are children, and I have Michelle's fabulous daughters and their children and everything, and we have created something here, which is
sort of a safe place, you know, or a harmonious place, a place where we've got family coming tomorrow, bringing their children so that they can experience what they experienced when they were with us, you know. So we have created a place here which is somewhere where people want to be.
Mm.
And that allows me to see that it's turned around, you know, and life has been, has given me something back.
Yes.
I've worked for it, but, you know, we all work for it, don't we?
Yes, yes. I mean, you can hardly say your life has been unproductive, really. No, no. It's fabulous. It's absolutely fabulous to talk to you, Carol. You have such a way with words. It's beautiful. And also, I have looked on the website at your little cottage and gone, that's where I'm going this summer when I get a week off.
Well,
I shall be in touch.
Fantastic. That will be lovely to meet you. Absolutely.
I look forward to meeting you in person, but it's been an absolute delight.
Thank you. I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
You have been listening to My Time Capsule with me, Mike Fenton-Stevens, and my lovely guest, Carol Drinkwater. I hope you enjoyed our continental chat. If you did, then do tell your friends and like or rate this podcast, or you can leave a comment or even a review. You can follow me and My Time Capsule on social media, where we're very happy to be contacted and have a chat about the podcast or our guests, or indeed receive suggestions for future guests you'd like to hear. You'll also discover what's happening on the podcast and what's or who's coming up. The theme tune is available on Spotify and was written, produced and performed by the talented Pass the Peas Music. In other words, our excellent producer, John Fenton Stevens. And if you missed our weekly bonus podcasts, then you can hear them if you subscribe to Acast Plus. You'll also get this podcast ad-free. This was a cast-off production for Acast. Right, time I got on with writing my own memoirs, don't you think? Obviously, I've written a number of books, but all under different pseudonyms. Well, I don't like to show off, as regular listeners will know. There was my book, Advantageous, by Benny Fischel. Bricklaying, by Bill Jerome Wall. My Favourite Pizza Topping, by Anchovy. Of course, there was Geology by Roxanne Minerals, and one of my favourites, The Lumberjack by Tim Burr. And I'm sure, of course, you'll remember My Worst Journey by Helen Back. So it's time for the real thing, the full Monty, the unvarnished truth, or as I'm going to call it, I can't believe how many people listen to my podcast to the very end. Bye.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.